you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Last week, I gave you a podcast recommendation, Sleep Whispers. Today, I'm going to recommend another podcast by the same creator. The podcast's name is Calm History, and it's exactly as it sounds. There are stories from history served in a very light, very calm voice by the creator to help you relax and even to fall asleep. If you suffer from insomnia, or perhaps you just feel that tightening of unwanted stress in your chest, Calm History is going to give you some relief. Listen to Calm History. I'll share a link for you in the show notes. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for listening to the Twilight Histories. Today is going to be a very different show from our regular catalog. This is not something I would suggest you listen to if this is your first time with us. If you're coming to us new and you want to get a feel for what we do, you could go back and check out some of our other shows. Some of my favorites are The Blight, Lord of Heligoland, The Paris Event, and some of our older shows like The Winged Victory and The Blood Ape. Today's show is a reflection and a tribute. It's a reflection on our earliest shows and where they came from. And it's a tribute to a particular podcast episode I heard way back in 2010 and that has since been taken down. I had to beg Rob Kane, the podcaster, for a copy of that show, and I'm going to play it for you right after you've heard me ramble on for a bit. The reason we're breaking format today is because we're still in our 10th year as a podcast, and I think it's worth looking back. You know, celebrate where we came from. And in a sense, this is kind of a history of history podcasting, at least from the limited perspective of the Twilight Histories. Basically, what I want to do for you today is describe how the Twilight Histories came into being. To do that, we have to go back to the start. And please excuse me for a little bit of autobiography. I'll try to get through this quickly. The first books I ever read and loved were from a series called Fighting Fantasy. And actually, I've started to collect them again and read them. They still hold up. Basically, Fighting Fantasy is a series the authors wanted to use to introduce young readers to role-playing games. So they are a kind of choose-your-own-adventure, but way cooler. The premise is, of course, that you are the hero. But unlike Choose Your Own Adventure, you get a sword, or a laser, or a Mad Max-style car with a rocket launcher. Then you go on an adventure where you're flipping pages, rolling dice, and, too often, dying horrible deaths. That's something we don't do often enough here at the Twilight Histories, and I think that should change. Each book is a little different, spanning from fantasy to horror to science fiction, so each new installment always felt fresh and new to me. Later on, I think I was about 12, I discovered ancient history, the Greeks and Romans, and I was blown away. What excited me about history was that the world building was so vast. You didn't just have a forest and a mountain filled with goblins. You had a huge, vast world with unique cultures in every valley, and all this spanned thousands of years. It was inexhaustible. It was at this point that I discovered there was a profession that explored the ancient world in a very intimate way. You didn't just read about the ancients. You got to actually go to the places where they lived and dig them up. So, if a Roman touched a stone, and that stone was covered in moss, and then dirt, and then the dirt piled up. And then you came with your trowel and scraped away the dirt. When you place your hand on that stone, you are the first person to touch it since the Roman. That's an electric feeling. What am I talking about? I'm talking about archaeology, of course. I was determined to be an archaeologist. In the late 90s, I was accepted to university and took every course in Greek and Roman studies and archaeology I could find. I loaded up. I wrapped up a double major with an excavation of a Roman fort in the Middle East. But here was the problem with archaeology for me. You may have guessed it. My sister certainly did. She bugged me endlessly about it. What was I going to do for work? Was I going to learn Italian and live in Italy? Probably not. This was honestly something I had completely blocked out of my mind in my radical pursuit of a childhood passion. After doing some archaeology in Ireland, I ended up working as a contract archaeologist in Canada for a while, and it was disappointing for me. I didn't get into archaeology to dig test trenches at the sides of highways out in the middle of nowhere. The pay was poor, I lived in hotels, and went to sleep exhausted from shoveling every day. I asked one of the older archaeologists if it was possible to have a family with this job. He looked at me with a mixture of surprise and sarcasm and said, "You want a family? Get out now." And I did. But that left a huge problem for me. What was I going to do? I bumbled around doing a lot of different jobs, and I did some travel. I ended up in Japan at one point in 2007. And that's when the next big chapter of this story happened, because that's when a friend introduced me to a new thing Apple had just put out called podcasting. As a former archaeologist and Roman fanatic, the first thing I looked up was a podcast on Roman history. And there it was, the History of Rome podcast by Mike Duncan. He had just started, and there were only a handful of episodes out at that time. I devoured them all, and hunted around for other history podcasts. There weren't many, and most were pretty amateur. There were a smattering of professors posting their lectures, and there was one guy trying to make a business selling low-quality CDs. The one big exception was Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. That show blew me away. He was only about 12 or 13 episodes in at the time, so still brand new. But the quality of storytelling was so outrageously good that even today he's regarded as a monolith. His shows were incredibly influential to me, and they really pointed to what was possible with this new podcasting medium. Still, I didn't think I was going to be a podcaster back in 2007. I was mostly into film and theater. I'd gotten into doing improv comedy and was part of a local film community. It was great fun. I decided to make my own film, a period piece about World War II. So we got some great sets and costumes and put together something I felt kind of proud of. But then the Great Recession hit, and my income dried up. So that film was never completed. I needed a creative outlet, but film was clearly too expensive. Then I remembered podcasting. Podcasting was, well, free. You just had to work on the imagination of the audience. And Dan Carlin had shown me that you could create some powerful images and shake the listener with just your voice. He didn't need to rent lights and costumes and find locations and get actors and all the rest. It was just him and a microphone. So it was around 2009 or 10 that I started to think seriously about creating a podcast. And that was an interesting time because there seemed to be a bit of an early podcasting boom going on. There were a bunch of new shows like The History of England and Norman Centuries. Podcasting was still so new at that time that you could really do anything with it. The field was wide open. So how should I proceed? What would be the format? When it came to history podcasts, there were really only two directions to follow at that time. There was the Mike Duncan style and the Dan Carlin style. I knew I wanted to follow the Dan Carlin model. But by that, I mean I wanted to create vivid, startling images. I wanted the listener to experience profound imagery, a quickening of the heart rate, big emotions, the kind of thing where you take off your headphones and sit there in the dark for a while, in silence, trying to process what you've just heard. And this goes back to archaeology again. I didn't just want to read books and study the ancient world. I wanted to actually go there, brush away the soil, and be the first person to touch the stones the ancients touched. Archaeology was all about having that electric shock experience. So that's what I wanted the podcast to do. But how do you do that? Dan could clearly do it, but I couldn't just copy Dan. I would only come off as a poor imitation. I needed something that was all my own, and finding your own voice is not as easy as you might think. Often, all the ingredients are there, but you just don't know how to put them all together. Then in March 2010, I heard it. Ancient Rome Refocused. It was a brand new podcast, and Rob Cain had just put out his second episode, Time Travel is Easy, History is Hard. When I heard that episode, something clicked. Because in that episode, what Rob did was take the listener on a journey in a time machine back to ancient Rome. You explored the streets with Rob as your guide. And it wasn't easy. No, it was hard. Everything was difficult, from bathing with olive oil to buying a slave. And what better way to draw the listener in than to make them the main character? It wasn't just an explanation about what life was like. No, this was you going on a journey and experiencing life in ancient Rome firsthand. This was your adventure. The more I thought about it, the more things started to click. This format, this time travel adventure format, could work just like those fighting fantasy game books I loved as a kid. Each episode, you'd get to go to a different place and time and experience a different world. You'd get to meet people and talk to them, perhaps form friendships, bonds, relationships, or vendettas. You wouldn't just be a tourist. You'd become the people you explored. After hearing the Ancient Rome Refocused episode for the first time, I began to brainstorm. I now knew I wanted to take the concept of you traveling back in time and experiencing the past, and I knew I wanted to infuse it with as much Dan Carlin as I could. And by that, I mean stimulating the canvas of the listener's imagination and infusing as much emotion into it as possible to make it vivid. I would use music and sound effects like an old radio drama or a Twilight Zone episode to heighten the experience. For the time machine, I would use the same type of machine H.G. Wells used. It would be a vehicle you could step into. You could use it to move forward and backwards in time, and you could watch time move like a video and fast forward or rewind. You were in control. For the first episode, I drew the subject matter from the first hardcore history episode I ever heard, Episode 9, Darkness Buries the Bronze Age. It was a story of civilization collapse. This was the vision for the first episode. You would travel back in time. You would experience the collapse of the Bronze Age, intimately, firsthand, and with as much intensity as I could draw. I wanted you, as the listener, to really feel you were there. In my vanity, my true hope was that I could use this new method, this time travel machine, to perhaps create an immersive experience that could stand alongside hardcore history. That was vanity, of course. My first attempt at podcasting was horrendous. Everything about it was bad. I logged about 30 hours between writing, recording, and editing, and I felt embarrassed by the results. My respect for Dan Carlin grew exponentially at that point. Imagine watching Michael Jordan slam dunk incredible shots, and you think to yourself, well, if I just create some shoes with springs in them, maybe I can slam dunk just like that. But of course, on your first try, you only end up slamming your face into the ground. That was how I felt about my first crack at podcasting. But I wanted to launch it anyways. Even though it wasn't very good, my hope was I would get better with time. It was only my first try, after all, and I really wanted to see if I could improve. After much thought, I called the podcast Twilight Histories. Twilight, in honor of Twilight Zone with all its creepiness, and histories like Hardcore History or The Histories of Herodotus. I called the first episode Lord of the Flies. It didn't get many listens. Under 10 in its first week, if I can remember correctly. But the thought that there were 10 people out there listening to my work was pretty cool. I wanted more. I fired off an email to the leading podcast reviewer at the time, at the blog called Anne is a Man. He'd given a glowing review to Ancient Rome Refocused, and I thought, hey, maybe you'd like the Twilight Histories. Anne responded with lukewarm enthusiasm, if you can even call it enthusiasm. In retrospect, I should have probably waited until I had something better to show him. For my second episode, I bought a new microphone. But that did nothing to save Priestess of Minos. This episode, too, was a disaster. My voice acting was terrible, and the story didn't quite work. My wife was properly embarrassed for me. For the third episode, I was determined. I would pull out all the stops. This one would be about ancient Rome. But here, I tried something novel. A what if? What if Rome never fell? I actually got this idea from a conversation I had with Rob Kane. Yes, I actually built up the courage to contact him. I asked him what kind of story he'd like to hear about Rome, and that was his idea. Something where Rome flourished. I needed music. I had heard a Radiolab episode that used music from this incredible cellist called Zoe Keating, and I contacted her and asked her permission to use her music for the show. I was going to get this one right. And to be fair, it wasn't bad. It ended up being slightly better than my first two. It still sounds a bit amateurish when I listen to it now, but I actually kind of like amateur works anyways. There's a freshness and an honesty to them, an unrefined excitement about starting something new. So episode 3, Rome Industrial, was, I think, a step up. Certainly not Dan Carlin, but a step up from the first two. For episode 4, I took all the lessons from Rome Industrial and applied them to Axis Earth, a time travel adventure where you got to explore a world conquered by the Axis powers in World War II. And this one was also not bad. Things were improving. I felt like I was getting into the swing of things. But at that point, I was bothered by something. The shows weren't digging deep enough. Sure, you got to fly around and see all sorts of things and watch history unfold, but there was no emotional connection involved. I wasn't giving you a reason to care. If you're floating above something, you're not invested in the story. You're an observer. You're just like a stone skipping on the surface. I wanted to deepen these stories, and to do that, I needed to get you out of the time machine more, walk around and meet people. But here's the problem. Sure, you could get out and walk around, but as soon as things heated up, you could always just get back in the time machine and escape. How could I force you to stay so the stories could actually have some excitement to them? If we damaged the time machine, then of course you'd be stuck until you fixed it, like in Back to the Future, and that would force you to engage with the world more. But we couldn't do that every episode. That's a one-time thing. So how do we force you to stick around, even when things heat up, so we actually get a story with all the heart-pounding intensity we want? Maybe the problem was with the time machine itself. I had just copied the H.G. Wells model, but it wasn't working for the kinds of stories I wanted to tell you. Maybe we needed something different. Maybe something like Stargate, or even better, like the wormholes used in the show Sliders. Or, duh, how about the wormhole used by Rob Kane in Ancient Rome Refocused? He even said, you're going to be stuck in this world for 2 years, and no one's coming to rescue you. So why reinvent the wheel? Just do that. All right, that was what we were going to do. Now, for the subject matter of this new test show. I had just seen a documentary about the Ice Age that was kind of like a nature show. You follow a couple humans who were separated from their band, and they have to survive under terrible conditions. You learn a lot about their world, their tools, and the type of problems they faced, all while following them on an epic journey of survival. So I thought I'd pick this as the subject for this new experimental time travel show using Rob Kane's method. I started it off with a kind of Rob Sterling-inspired intro, where I talk to you as the listener and prepare you for what you're about to experience. Then I invite you to step on the platform and get you on your way. And thus was born Ice Age Misery. This was the first show I really felt clicked. I was pleased with it. It felt like the format could sustain itself, and it allowed for all the depth and richness that I could craft. Now, what to do with those earlier episodes? I removed the first 4 shows and made Ice Age Misery episode 1. From then on, that would be the format of the Twilight Histories. And the rest is history, as they say. I'm now going to play that early seminal episode by Rob Kane for you. It's called Time Travel is Easy, History is Hard. Like I mentioned earlier, this show doesn't exist out there anymore. Rob took it down. And I have to thank him for allowing me to play it for you today. As I said, I took down all my early experiments in podcasting, where I was testing out the new time travel format. So this is Rob's early work from back in 2010, and Rob is still podcasting today, so he's a seasoned podcaster. But because it was so influential to me in the Twilight Histories, I really want to show it the honor of remaining alive in a treasured position here in the Twilight Histories. For me, this show is a piece of history, a keystone, a landmark, and it's a show I've listened to and thought about many times over the years. Listen closely, and you'll hear all the ingredients of the Twilight Histories. The intro music, the orientation where Rob sets the scene before your departure, the creepy time travel sound effects, and then you're off through the wormhole, and it's you who's going. Because this is your adventure. Thank you, Rob Kane, for letting me play this. This is Ancient Rome Refocused, the original Episode 2, Time Travel is Easy, History is Hard, from way back in 2010, back when podcasting was new.
In association with the Museum of the Antiquities Project, this is Ancient Rome Refocused with your host, Rob Kane. History for the Brave.
Hello, everybody. This is Rob Kane. Welcome to Ancient Rome Refocused. The title of this podcast is Time Travel is Easy, History is Hard. In the 60s, when I was a kid, I sat in front of the TV watching the Saturday night movie. Now, those of you on a certain age may not remember that there was not a lot of choice of cable stations at that time. You had three choices, ABC, NBC, or CBS. The movie that night was Ben-Hur, starring Charlton Heston. Ben-Hur was a prominent Jewish merchant who was sold into slavery as a galley slave and is lucky enough to save a Roman commander's life during a sea battle. Quintus Arius is so overwhelmed by Ben-Hur's resolve to live that he adopts him as his son out of gratitude. Now, adoption like this was not unusual in patrician families, by the way. High death rate at birth and the dangers of living, well, adoption kind of made up for the shortages of heirs. The Roman commander was played by Jack Hawkins.
We keep you alive to serve this ship. So rule well and live.
And the movie is based on the 1880 novel by Lew Wallace. You have to read this book once in your life, and then see the movie as a treat. Ben-Hur the movie premiered in 1959 and won 11 Academy Awards. I remember sitting in front of the TV, totally enthralled as the scene of the Roman triumph played out. Soldiers marched down the Via Triumphalis to the sound of music. Crowds pressed forward, waving and shouting their praise. Now, a triumph is headed by magistrates, followed by trumpeteers with carts filled with the spoils of war, and then white bulls are pulled through the streets on their way to sacrifice, and the arms and insignias of the conquered enemy are carted on wagons so that the public may view that the victory is real. Now remember, this is staged propaganda, allowing you as the public to spit, throw things, and shout out vile insults. Next comes the lictors, dispensers of justice. Lictors are usually a person carrying a a package of rods with an axe shoved in, and it's all tied together. It's a symbol of power. But it did have a purpose. The rods could be used to beat people, and the axe to carry out capital punishment. Following them was the Imperator, the victorious general. Now, Imperator means to rule, to govern, and he usually in the triumph, he is rides on a chariot and is pulled by horses. And just after that, his sons follow in a place of honor, and then the officers that support his victory, and then possibly after that, the troops that helped in the victory. Now, in the movie, Arius had defeated the Macedonian pirates, and he rides in a chariot in front of his troops, with Judah by his side. Well, after all, Judah pulled him out of the water and prevented him from committing suicide. Judah deserved a place of honor as far as the Roman commander was concerned. Now, I wasn't more than 10 years old at the time, and without taking my eyes off the TV, I said to my brother, who I knew was on the couch and behind me, "Do you think it was like that?" And I still remembered what he said. "I think it was better." I knew at that moment, if my brother had a time machine, he would have gone back just so he could have seen for himself. In this episode, I want to accept without question that time travel is possible. I know you thought you downloaded a podcast on ancient Rome. You have, and you are in the right place. But for the purpose of argument and for the purpose of studying the past, we are going to put aside the problems of physics and the issues of screwing with the space-time continuum. By the way, I threw that in for you Star Trek fans. And we're going to accept that time travel is possible, at least for the space of time of this podcast. And what if someone offered you the chance to travel back into time? What would you say? Would you go? Think of the money you would make from book sales alone and the movie rights. Think of the fame. I can already see the title of your book, Real Time in Ancient Rome. It would sell millions. It would be on top of the bestseller list for years. Okay, you need more information. Okay, here it is. My contacts from the laboratory have told me the following. The journey will be for 2 years. You can't take anything with you except a tunic, sandals, and a bag of coins, and the return trip is set in stone. You are there for 2 years. There will be no rescue operation, and there is no panic button. To my knowledge, you're going to be dropped through a miniature black hole. Still want to volunteer? Now, wait a minute. I can guess the kind of emails that I'm going to get, besides the accusation that I'm crazy because time travel is an impossibility. But we were only talking the probability, weren't we not? I know someone out there is going to send me an email that asks the following question. Why don't you go? What's wrong with you? Now, if you want to know if I would do it, here's my answer. No. No, are you kidding? Not in a million years. Do you think I'm out of my mind? The following are 7 reasons to turn down traveling to ancient Rome. Here they come. You ready? Reason 1. Medicine was lousy in ancient Rome. As a time traveler, you better be in good health. Well, for one thing, I wear glasses. The optics of grinding glass to cure vision problems is basically high technology to the Romans. In fact, it was high technology just a few hundred years ago. It is something that would mark you as different, and being a time traveler, you really want to blend in. As silly as it sounds, wearing glasses could get you killed, so send someone with 20/20 or wear contacts, but if you lose the lenses, don't expect to run down to your local Eyes Only to pick up another set. Contacts, during Roman times, would be like me pulling out an iPod in the 1700s. In regards to medicine, well, I picked up a good time to enter middle age. There are considerable medicines that help prolong life. And what about the minor aches and pains? Are you going to find any aspirin in 51 BC? Ancient Romans believed that diseases were brought on by the disfavor of the gods, and many doctors performed rituals and spells to rid the body of disease. A prayer to the goddess Juno will not cure me of the bone spur on my left foot. I'm not saying that medicine was not existent in the Roman world. Whether we like it or not, war always brings advances in technology and knowledge. Rome was a martial state. Physicians learned by doing, and the first hospitals were built by the military. When you have plenty of sword wounds, you can guess that doctors would get pretty good in curing sword wounds. What's more, physicians must have gained considerable knowledge of the healing of cuts and the purpose of nerves and the repair of muscles. Practice, in this case, does make perfect. Augustus, the first Roman emperor, established the first army medical corps. Now, Roman doctors knew of arteries and the veins that carried blood, and considering the nature of war and the peacetime interest in gladiatorial games, this is no surprise. The arena would have provided plenty of patients for individual doctors to gain knowledge. Tourniquets, arterial clamps, and ligatures were used to stem blood flow. There was even a wide range of sedatives and painkillers, but take it from a person who's had extensive surgery on his feet and a lot of dental work. Don't take my Percocet, please. So what's the problem, you ask? Well, imagine that you have a book on your kitchen table that contains the sum total of medical knowledge that we know today. Imagine that you're able to eliminate that knowledge from the minds and practices of the medical profession simply by tearing the pages out. Now reach over and rip out 90% of the pages. Do it. Do it now. Now hope, just hope, that you don't get ill at the time you need that knowledge. This is the world you'll live in for the next 2 years. A sword cut, a doctor may be able to help you with, but suffer from epileptic fits and you're entering the realm of the gods. And you have another problem. Do you have enough money to get the medical care that you need? You're not going to be very rich back in ancient Rome. And the problem really doesn't change today either. The best medical care goes to the people with the most money. How much sestersi do you have in your pocket? Do you still want to go back to ancient Rome? Reason 2. Everyday life was dangerous. As a time traveler, you better take a gun. Oops, sorry. The space-time continuum and not allowed. Well, a good time traveler better know how to use a sword anyway, and wait a minute. When's the last time you practiced using a sword and shield? Well, you're going to need it. In 51 BC, it was not unusual to have to flee your city once in a while from the threat of invading armies. The price of having your city sacked is your family will be sold off and your women raped. Politics was for keeps in ancient times. Get on the wrong side and your town was surrounded. The army pounded down your front gate, then soldiers went methodically from house to house, taking your possessions, if they had time, raping your wife and daughter, then selling you and your family into slavery. If you want to appreciate the politics we have in the U.S. today, tell me the last time your house was burned down because the opposing party won the election. But that's just the United States. I don't want to trivialize this. It's still going on. Cities are being burned to the ground. Populations decimated. Cities have been sacked in ancient times, and they have been sacked in modern times. Another word for sacked is the word razed. And I can come up with some modern equivalents for that act. And I don't even have to leave the 20th or the 21st century. While in ancient history Xerxes made an example of Aridius, what did the Japanese do to Shanghai? The Carthaginians razed Corinth, and Dresden was firebombed. The Romans destroyed Carthage, utterly, to the point of tearing down its walls and salting the earth around it so farming could not take place. The U.S. dropped an atomic bomb in Hiroshima. The Germans laid siege to Stalingrad, literally starving the inhabitants. And what did the Russians do to Berlin in retribution? I believe there are many people in Serbia and Bosnia that have experienced the threat of annihilation and have escaped a burning city or a burning house in the night. Yes, modern life is dangerous. But, you know, you still remember Hiroshima. You remember Dresden, Berlin, and Stalingrad. And many of these cities have boomed in the post-war economy. But what do we really know of Carthage, except what the victors have written about them or chose to tell us? The memories are Roman memories and are devoid of detail. Have your city sacked, and if anything is left, human or treasure, it will be cataloged and shipped to Rome. Life was dangerous, and there was profit in destroying the next town. At that time, gangs ruled the streets, and one didn't have a police force to settle disputes or to try to protect you, at least not till the time of Augustus. If you had a grief with your neighbor, you grabbed whatever weapon at hand and you went at it. Yes, there were courts, but courts took money, and juries were only for rich people who could afford the bribes. A common citizen in 51 BC had to settle disputes on their own. Getting someone to court only occurred if you were able to capture that person and get him through the door. When is the last time you captured someone? And the mob. The mob was feared in Rome, barely controlled by the promise of free food and games. Attempts were made to control the uncontrollable. Places like cafes, inns, and taverns had restrictions placed in them under the Republic and several emperors. The average life expectancy was 20 to 30 years. This is considered optimistic. Reason 3. Food was terrible and limited in variety. As a time traveler, you better have a Big Mac before you leave, because it's the last one you're going to get for quite a long time. What's more, as a time traveler, you better have a cast-iron stomach. Do you think you'll be attending some great Roman banquet every day? Not likely. Your diet will be the same day in and day out. You'll not be able to afford meat. Don't expect to be eating bread all the time. It was expensive back then. As a time traveler, you got a problem. In 2 years, you're going to lose a lot of weight, and considering the weight problems of those living today, this might be a good thing. Yes, nutrition is an issue. Fruit and vegetables can provide you with the required vitamins. The question is, what fruits and vegetables can you get, and what existed at that time? Don't expect that food will always be available in quantity. Famine was a common problem. People lived from season to season, and keeping food for later was limited. There was no such thing as refrigeration. Those bringing food to market farmed on a small scale. And don't even bother to ask what fertilizers they were using. You don't want to know. Reason 4. Hygiene was poor. As a time traveler, you better take a good long bath before you leave, because it might be the last one you're going to get for quite a while. In the morning, expect to wash your face in a pail of water. That is, if you have some water by your bed. Expect to wash your face in the same pail of water, unless you're prepared to lug it 2 blocks to the fountain, or you go to the window and throw it out, or you go to the railing and pour it out onto the street. If you take a piss and then wash your hands, the next time you wash your hands, you're dipping your hands in the pail of water that you placed your germs. Of course, you can solve this by making sure that you always have fresh water, but you're probably going to have to lug the bucket a couple of blocks to get it. Now here's a question. Where did you piss, and where did you dispose of that? And where do you think everyone else is disposing their waste? Do you see where I'm going with this? Well then, go buy a slave. If you're tired of lugging a pail of water, go hire the lowest form of human life at that time, the water carrier. Water is 8.3 quarters pounds per gallon. Imagine having to do that all day up and down the stairs. Did the streets stink? Of course. Did people smell? More than likely. In fact, a certain amount of aroma was probably acceptable due to the times. In other words, if you can stand my smell, I will certainly stand yours. Was lice common? Of course it was. How often do you think the average Roman washed his or her clothes? The average payment to enter the baths was 1/4 ass. Ass was a payment, a coinage. The payment of an ass is pretty much affordable, even to the poor. Bath buildings comprised a suite of hot, warm, and cold pools for you to remove the grime of the day. These places even contain swimming pools and gymnasiums. This all sounds pretty good, right? Sort of like a high-priced health club? Well, what do health clubs cost nowadays? $350 a year? Maybe $600? I'm sure that Roman baths varied in size and facilities by the strength of the clientele, don't most places? Do you think that the common laborer could afford to hit the baths every day? If human nature has not changed in a couple of thousand years, and if an ass stands between you and eating, well, the bath can wait. What kind of soap did they use? Was there soap at all? Oh, and the answer is no. I mean, they used oil to remove soil from their skin. Try it. Get your hands dirty, then rub your hands with olive oil and see if it breaks up the dirt. How did they remove the muck? With a sturgeon. It's kind of like a dull blade. Most likely, It was scraped off the skin. And usually they had a slave or a buddy or a friend or a relative to do it for them. I can imagine the aroma afterwards was not anything near Dial soap or Irish Spring. How were clothes cleaned back then? Vats of sulfur in human urine. You heard me. Human urine. It was used as a form of bleach. I don't expect the Time Travel Committee is going to send you back with a lot of money, with the price of gold nowadays. You're going to have to rely on your wits to get by. And unless you can carry enough coinage, you're going to be living in the lower edge of society. Washing is a matter of logistics. How close is the nearest fountain? There'll be no powder room on every floor. Running water in a sink will be hard to find. Baths are located how many feet away? Fountains are how far down the road? Rivers are how close to your doorstep? You're going to smell. Face it. Enjoy the aroma. Reason 5. The entertainment was different. Imagine a world that there are no movies, no TV, no iPod, no computer, no webcasts, no podcasts, no radio. In this time, you're going to have to rely on books, plays, and people for your entertainment, and you better be able to read Latin and understand it. Do you like a good wrestling match? More than likely, that's available. There was even a form of dice called bones, and you could listen to music. Various types of instruments existed at the time, drums, cymbals, and string instruments. People were not too different. They danced and sang songs, even back then. A pastime of the Romans was horse racing. You could go for a play. There were comedies and tragedies on various subjects. The plot lines are vaguely familiar. Boy gets girl, boy loses girl, boy buys girl, boy kidnaps girl from her father. Boy raises money to get the attention of his favorite prostitute. Oh, don't raise an eyebrow to that last one. Remember the 1983 movie Risky Business with Tom Cruise? Well, I could just see it. Throw everyone into a toga, add a slave to deliver key comedic lines, and periculos negotium, periculos space, negotium, periculos negotium, risky business in English, would probably do a reasonable business for a Greek and Roman audience in 51 BC. So far, it sounds pretty good, right? I mean, game of dice, musical instruments, plays, not too different from now. But it is different. And the biggest difference is what people considered entertainment at that time, and it was called gladiatorial game. Do you want to go to a gladiatorial game? It's just like football, right? Tell me the last football game you went to where the victims in the arena were disemboweled, eaten, burned, and drowned in wholesale battles. Victims were staked to crosses and wrapped with cloth, immersed in oil and pitch, and then lit up like a torch. I mean, watching violent movies is one thing. Watching stage violence and death where the victims are real is another. How strong is your stomach anyway? And what's more, how long will it be until you develop a taste for the carnage? Don't tell me you don't have a taste for it. I mean, for the violence of the arena. I see hints of it in modern day. Look at the way cars slow down on highways during an accident. I mean, there's no reason for them to slow down, but they do. They always do. And that's because somebody decided to slow down to see what carnage they could see. And another thing, look at the movies that are in Hollywood. There seems to be a propensity of violent films. Let me tell you a story. Saint Augustine writes of a friend called Alpheus who went to Rome to study law. He was asked by some friends to join them at a gladiatorial game. He made his opinion known of what he thought of such a spectacle. Augustine quotes him as saying, "If you drag my body to that place and sit me down there, do not imagine you can turn my mind and my eyes to that spectacle. I shall be as one not there, and so I shall overcome both you and the game." End of quote. Well, it did not work out that way. Alpheus was dragged to a gladiatorial game by his friends, and the results are recorded by Augustine. Quote, "When they arrived and found seats where they could, the entire place seethed with the most monstrous delight in the cruelty. He kept his eyes shut, and forbade his mind to think about such fearful evils. Would that he block his ears as well? A man fell in combat. A great roar from the entire crowd struck Alpheus with such vehemence that he was overcome by curiosity. Supposing himself strong enough to despise whatever he saw and to conquer it, he opened his eyes. He was struck in the soul by a wound graver than the gladiator in his body whose fall had caused the roar. As soon as he saw the blood, he at once drank in savagery in the murderous contest and was inebriated by the blood-thirsty pleasure. He was not the same person who had come in, but just one of the crowd which he joined, and a true member of the group that had brought him. He looked, he yelled, he was on fire. He took the madness with him so that it urged him to return, not only with those by whom he had originally been drawn there, but even more than them, he took others with him. End of quote. If Alpheus could not hold out against the temptations of the arena, how do you think you're going to do?
O tempora amores, senatus haec videt, consul cognoscit, haec est torpissima sentina.
Reason 6, you don't speak the language. As a time traveler, I hope you paid attention in Catholic school or took classical studies while you were in college. There's nothing lonelier than being in another country and not knowing the language. Conversation with friends may be your only entertainment. Wait, you're a time traveler with bad Latin. You can scratch the idea of having long and interesting conversation with friends. You, my friend, are alone. Latin has been called a dead language and used mostly by the church and the scientific community to classify data. Today, the only people that I think could carry on a conversation in the language is possibly a classical scholar or a priest. But you know, if you drop these two guys into downtown Rome, ancient downtown Rome, I think they'd be hard-pressed to comprehend what was being said to them. How a language is spoken over the years changes. Even modern languages are spoken differently in the same country where people are divided by regions and geography. But people overcome this and survive because the regional speakers help the non-regional speakers get past the obstacles. Even a Cambridge graduate in England knows a little Cockney. Where are you going to find someone that lived in 51 BC to teach you how to ask for directions in the form and the proper inflection?
Rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
His way of saying the word form may be slightly different than your neighborhood classical scholar. What's more, what kind of Latin is he speaking?
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
It seems there was a high Latin spoken by the noble elite called patricians and street Latin spoken by the common people called plebeians. Anyway, how can we be sure that the Latin spoken today by our select few, the church and classical scholars, is even comparable to the language spoken in 51 BC. You're taking a risk. In 1974, I was in high school, and we had an exchange student from Yorkshire, England. She met me in the hall, and she asked me a question. For the life of me, I could not understand her. She was speaking English, no question of it, but I was used to hearing the words in another way. She repeated again and again, and finally I had to say to her, I really don't understand. Now, she had a hurt look on her face, and I regretted hurting her feelings, but it was the truth. I'm not saying that I didn't understand her the rest of the time, but at that particular moment, I could not make out the words. What did Winston Churchill say? The United States and Great Britain are two nations divided by a common language. Now, a couple of hundred years and an ocean made that division. So how would our understanding of Latin change with a couple of thousand years to divide us? You better use your 2 years in Rome to your best advantage. Make sure you don't get into trouble. Don't speak much at first. Ask for little things like food and water. Try out a word here or there. Pretend to be mute so no one talks to you. Listen very carefully to conversations until you can master it on your own. Reason 7. You will be seduced by the slavery that you see around you. I couldn't get a recording of an actual slave auction. I couldn't even find one in a clip from a movie somewhere. I'm sure it's out there somewhere, but I couldn't find one. So here's a recording of an auction, just to put you in the mood.
I am going by our number. That's 450 straight. 450 straight. And here's my set again.
As a time traveler, I hope you're able to set aside your morals and compassion until you get back. All the 20th century morals of fair play and do unto others as they would do unto you, you better put on hold. Spend 2 years in Rome, and slavery will become a part of you. You will accept it as the natural state of things. Well, heck, you already do. In case you don't know it, you live in an age of cheap goods being provided by immigrant labor. Gym shoes and jeans made in Chinese sweatshops flood our markets. Well, I can hear you say, well, yes, but they're paid for their work. It's not the same thing. Well, in ancient Rome, some people sold themselves into slavery just to eat, to be clothed, to have a chance to live another day. Is this much different than having to accept a wage that is barely enough to feed yourself or your family? Is economic slavery any worse than human slavery? Is the slavery of women in the sex trade any different than the slavery of ancient times? Why is it that the news reports always seem to have something about people being held against their will for the purpose of labor? And the word labor means many things. How about political Chinese prisoners laboring in factories under a life sentence? How about Asian women laboring behind high fences on an island to make high-priced athletic shoes? Or women imported into the United States and held captive in an apartment? That was a recent TV news report. What were they being held captive for? Don't fool yourself. Slavery is out there. And yes, there are laws against it. But in certain forms, it seems to be tolerated. And in ancient Rome, slavery is everywhere. It's not hidden behind closed doors or in some obscure country or behind an ideology or legal hocus-pocus. Slaves are in the brothels, they work in the shops, they labor in the fields. Everything you touch has the smell of slavery attached to it. Slaves sweep up the dung in the streets. They wait on customers. They perform household chores. They dig out ore from the mines. It takes 8 people to run a proper household in ancient Rome. What self-respecting Roman could possibly get along without a cook, cook assistant, washerwoman, manservant, sewing woman, lady's maid, butler, or secretary? One time in the Senate, it was proposed that all slaves should wear yellow tunics to identify themselves. It was voted down. The Roman citizens feared that slaves, if they knew how much they outnumbered the free citizens, that they would revolt and try to gain their freedom. So let's try to keep the numbers secret. If you have moral objections to slavery, you're going to have to overcome them. Because slaves exist in that world because they were needed. I mean, why build machines? Why have innovation and mechanics when muscles, legs, and arms are in quantity for you to exploit? At the time, slaves were considered talking tools. In fact, that's what they were called. The slavery of ancient Rome was unusual, though. Slaves could possibly earn money for themselves, possibly buy their freedom, and masters could release them from bondage under the laws of manumission. Of course, you were called a freed man, and you were expected to keep your loyalty to your former master, a form of slavery in itself. A freed man was recorded to have over 4,000 slaves attributed to his household when he died. Imagine you start your life as a slave, free yourself through your own innovation and the generosity of your master, and then become so successful you end your life with 4,000 lives dedicated to your comfort. There's success for ya! This man was not only seduced, but adopted it as a way of life. So how strong are you? Now, you might have moral objections to slavery. I know what you're going to do. You're going to buy slaves and free them, right? As a time traveler, I don't think you're going to have a lot of money to spend. Slaves cost anywhere between 500 to 1,500 denarii. And they could be more, depending upon if they have a talent. Oh, You like that pretty girl on the block, the one with the pouty lips. You must save her from her fate. Ah, sorry. She went for 2,000 denarii. Senator Plukas is feeling amorous tonight. No matter, you'll try for the flute player. But your money pouch is not heavy enough. Slaves with talent are considered a worthwhile bid. The number goes up. 100, 200, and to your amazement, the final bid is 4,000 denarii. Well, Romans love their music. So let's say you did have the 4,000 denarii and you bought the young flute player. He is a boy named Flaccus. You take him to the street, you free him under the rules of manumission, and he is amazed, and the boy runs down the street alive, jumping and dancing like a small dog released from a collar to run free in the field. Good job. Strike a blow for 21st century morality. But 2 weeks later, you see the boy again. He is dirty and has a welt under one eye. He tried to make money playing his flute on the street corner, but how much could he really make? He made a few coppers at most, if that. At least a slave would have a place to sleep, clothes, and food. His flute playing would have an audience whenever you called him to perform. And when he sees you, he drops at your feet exhausted. He begs you for him to become your slave again. He begs you for you not to send him away. What does your 21st century morality say now? I think most of you would take him back. Guess what? You now own a slave. Like Alpheus in the arena, you've been seduced by 51 BC.
That was Time Travel is Easy, History is Hard by Rob Kane from the podcast Ancient Rome Refocused. It was an episode that helped inspire the Twilight Histories, and I'm very grateful to Rob Kane for letting me play it for you. In this show, I wanted to tell you something about where the Twilight Histories came from, those early years. There were lots of developments that came after Ice Age Misery, and each episode has its own backstory. The most important developments happened over the past few years when we began adding new voices to the show, starting with Josh Hutchins, who helped revive the podcast when I was despairing I couldn't keep it up. I soon asked some seasoned podcasters who I'd admired for years to join, Kevin Valbonesi and Tristan Verboven. But all this goes well beyond what I wanted to tell you about today, which is the very early story of how the Twilight Histories was born. And of course, I wanted to play that important episode of Ancient Rome Refocused for you. If you're curious about those first four shows I mentioned, they still exist, though I've hidden them deep in our Patreon archive. If you want to dig them up like an archaeologist and listen to them, they're called Lord of the Flies, The Priestess of Minos, please don't listen to that, Rome Industrial, and Access Earth. I'd only recommend the last two, which I still feel quite nostalgic about. Signing up to Patreon and joining our community is really the best way you can help keep this podcast going. We've been running for 10 years, and we have 100 episodes in the feed. If you believe in this show and want to see it continue for another 10 years, and hopefully hundreds more episodes, then please become part of our story and join us on Patreon. You can find our Patreon page by going to the website and clicking on the link, or by going directly to Patreon and running a search for The Twilight Histories. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for listening to The Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.